David Ellis will speak to us, a spatial networks and probability.
Okay, thanks. Thank the organizers as usual, and thank the audience for sticking around to the end. It was a pleasure. My talk has a different style from most talks here in several ways. Mostly people doing mathematics, you'll start from previous mathematics and build upon that. And of course, I do that ultimately, but my strategy for finding math problems is to start by looking at some interesting data. Again, so I'm not claiming to do serious statistical analysis of data. I just like looking at data as an inspiration for math questions, and sometimes you get different math questions that way. Little aside, I have lots of advice for young people that nobody ever takes, but I still plug away. If you want to make an impact in new theory, should you choose a field with a lot of theory and no data, or choose a field with a lot of data and no theory? To me, it's self-evident you should do the second. It's a harmonic rule. The nth paper on a topic has chance about 1 over n of having an impact. So you kind of want to write the first paper in something. Galton and Watson, Hardy and Wright, etc. Not great depth. So, again, no one listens to me. It's a kind of fault of the apprentice PhD system that theoreticians choose theoretical advisors. But anyway, choose a field with a lot of data and no theory. Also, again, I'm rambling a bit here. I teach an undergraduate probability in the real world course. I'm thinking about that because I'm going to teach it in fall. I have 20 topics, maximally different. These are the students' vote. I ask them to sort of vote in the social network idea of sort of like or dislike each class, and so these are likes versus dislikes. Why am I saying that? For several reasons. So firstly, because I wanted to throw in one that was somewhat related to my own research, and spatial networks is by far the most concrete thing I do that I can explain a bit to undergraduates. And also I'm involved in having undergraduates help with research, not of course in theorem proving, but in collecting data or coding, etc. Anyway, so that's sort of part of what I'm interested in. So, how might I start a spatial networks class for undergraduates? And, I like pictures. You can probably, even though you can't see in detail anything here, you kind of know what they are. These are pictures of the subway networks of various very large cities around the world. And so there's a lot of structure here, but let's just think of them as sort of graphs. So instead of all actual things that go on in a subway system, I'm just thinking of this as sort of the stations as vertices and bits, routes between stations as edges. So think of these as graphs. There's a fairly recent paper that just looked at this, collected a bunch of descriptive statistics about these things, and came up with the conclusion that the sort of generic form of a large subway system is a rather sort of highly connected core separated by, let me sort of sketch here, so imagining sort of a central area with sort of lots of routes crossing it, and then when you go out to the suburbs you tend to have things going out and branching. So there's some conceptual picture here, which you can visually see very roughly appearing in the real world examples. Again, so that's the paper. You can find anything on Google Scholar. Subway systems of very large cities consist of a highly connected core with branches radiating outwards. Now, depending on your sort of intuition for these things, you might sort of say this is a surprising and remarkable observation, or you might call it breathtakingly obvious. The analogy that comes to me for anyone British of my generation, which probably is nobody, but maybe to other people, and I'm sort of being polite here. Can you stop the? Do you have a method of kind of doing a Nixon and sort of cutting the tape for 10 seconds? Just I'm being humorous. Okay, we won't do it. So MPBL, Monty Python Brontosaurus Lady. Oh, no, nobody knows the reference. Okay, we'll pass on that. But sort of the description of a Brontosaurus is sort of thin at both ends and thick in the middle. And this is somehow their description of subways as sort of thin at both ends and thick in the middle. Okay, I'm being humorous here. Regardless of to what extent
this was proved by M. Elk.
Oh, am I? NL, there you go. That's right. They should have done it. I didn't even look at all the authors on the paper. But yes, that's very good, yeah. Okay, however, being more serious, you can think of a math project here where I sort of make some little math model of a generic kind of 20th century city where sort of people are typically traveling from the suburbs to the center rather than edge cities nowadays. And then you sort of think of, you know, hypothetically building a subway network and model costs and benefits of any particular topology of the network. And then there's some optimal network, probably optimal networks of one-parameter families, because you're doing a trade-off between costs and benefits, and then you can sort of compare that with data of this particular style. Doing anything like this is kind of insanely too hard to do by pencil and paper, so this notion of optimal networks, you're basically having to do sort of some numerical sort of heuristic optimization algorithms to output what you think of optimal networks. Any sorts of proofs about detailed nature of optimal networks seem very hard. So again, but this is sort of an example of, you know, a math project. You could maybe do this as a master's thesis project, which is sort of inspired by looking at actual data. This hasn't been done, but let me tell you pictures from, you know, an analogous project that people have done, again, on their own, not from me. So what's done here is they've taken, as you recognize, the actual map of the United States. They've discretized it into the 200 pieces, and there's a little, it doesn't show up very well, but there are little dots here kind of at the center of one of these 200 pieces. Averages are all population weighted. They're putting in sort of the actual population here. And now they're sort of thinking of, again, hypothetical networks linking all United States represented by these 200 cities. But they put in a parameter. We want to imagine something like passenger air travel. You know, if you want to, you can think of a simple model for the time it takes you to go from one place to another by air, then the simplest model is to say that it depends on the sort of total length of the route, but it also depends on how many times you have to change planes. Basically, having to change planes adds about 2 hours to a trip compared to a direct flight. So one can have a parameter, a variable parameter, which is the little delta in the slides, which is sort of a measure of the relative costs of traveling a certain distance versus having to change from sort of one step of your journey to another step of the journey. And these pictures show sort of, again, simulated optimal networks for different values of the parameter. The point is, if you think about it, for a road network, there's basically no cost in when one road meets another, there's essentially no cost in time of switching from one road to the other. So that's the top left system. And the top left system is at least qualitatively similar to the actual interstate system. If you didn't know what the interstate system in the United States looked like, then showing this and showing some equally dense part of the real network, you couldn't really tell which is which. Similarly, if you then go to the actual passenger air transport system, the sort of top right, or look at the top right or the bottom left pictures, these are remarkably similar to the hub and spoke networks that the American Airlines sort of introduced in the 1980s. You can centralize on a few places, and they even have some of the actual simulated hubs in places like Atlanta, which are the actual, and Denver, which are the actual hubs here. If you then go to the other extreme, where there's a large cost in sort of moving from one route to the other, again, that's the model for overnight package delivery, and basically you have one hub and send everything to one hub. And as you may know, FedEx and UPS do this to Tennessee or Kentucky. The simulated version does it to Cincinnati, but somehow it's exactly the mimics the real one. So this is a kind of, you know, a trivially simple model that isn't intended to kind of be quantitatively realistic, but does a surprisingly good job of reproducing the both qualitative features that seem intuitive and qualitative features of real networks. So this is from a 2006 paper by Mark Newman and a student. So these two examples are part of a broad statistical physics literature. If you go to Google Scholar and search on spatial networks, you get this survey paper by our statistical physicist in Paris, Barthélemy. I don't think I can pronounce the French exactly. And that's sort of 90 pages, cites 238 papers, mostly from statistical physics. And again, it's not about proofs, it's about little models and little examples like this. So just as these last two things I suggested, there's sort of a huge number of sort of implicit problems. You know, does this particular data and graphic actually suggest something math? So let me give one example. So I'm going to spend five minutes on talking quickly through one model and a result without many details. Again, this is almost the only thing I'm going to say. It's probably the least mathematically deep thing theorem given in this conference. Again, so the issue isn't to show off clever math, it's just to sort of show the style of sort of formalizing ideas. So I kind of want to formalize the hub and spoke picture here, that under some conditions this is an optimal network. Yes? The delta parameter is a relative weight of, I'm looking at I'm imagining the time to go from A to B depends on the total length of the route in miles plus the number of times you have to switch from one part of the journey to another part of the journey. So we imagine, again, we're imagining these as airplane flights, say. So it's just the number of times you have to change planes. Yeah. And the delta is a relative weighting here. Yeah, so somehow 0.5 to 1.0 is sort of twice the time waiting. Yeah. Okay, so as I said, there's actually no probability in here. Somewhere, probability is going to enter the story when we start modeling city positions or the underlying spatial positions as being random. So again, this is a little hard to understand precisely in the real time, but I'll talk through it. So again, we're in the same setting as what I was just saying, with weighting parameter delta for costs of transfers. My standardization when I talk about n to infinity asymptotics of n points is to kind of standardize the density of points as one per unit area. So if I have n cities, I'm thinking of them as a squared area n. I was pleased in Yuval's talk on Monday that I convinced him to do that. Of course, this may be a more familiar setting to stochastic geometry people, but the kind of random geometric graphs people are resistant to doing it this way. Anyway, so I have n cities in the square of area n. I'm imagining what I'm trying to minimize, the time to traverse a given route, depends on the Euclidean route length plus some parameter delta times the number of times I have to change plane. Of course, I go by the minimum time route, so for each pair of points there's a minimum time route. I then think of a sort of time parameter associated by my network. I'm getting to choose a network GN, but the sort of criterion I'm going to use to choose a network is to minimize this sort of average over pairs of cities of the time to take it. And in the way I've set things up, this is sort of intrinsically lower bounded by something depending on the geometry of the points, the average distance between points. So I'm sort of minimizing the sort of excess over the sort of intrinsic time to go in straight lines between points. And again, this excess is due to not having direct Euclidean routes as well as the cost of changing planes. But again, in principle, we're given the configuration of cities, and given constraints on total length and given this parameter, then there's some network that optimizes this criterion. And there's a natural guess as to one sort of network that might do well, which is exactly an idealization of a hub and spoke network, and it's easier by picture. So I'm imagining my n cities are in a big square of area n. I'm going to divide this into subsquares of some size to be chosen later. In each subsquare, I choose one city to be my hub. I then do little routes on small planes from each other city in the square to that hub, and then I have direct flights between every pair of hubs, so I have the complete graph on hubs and then these little leaves over there. And there's an acute freshman calculus thing here. So if I want to optimize over L, if I want to optimize the total network length, what L do I choose? Again, L is the side length of the sum squares. So my short routes from my short routes from a city to the neighboring hub, there are n cities, so order n of them, my squares have side length n, so that's order n times L. If I want to look at the total length of the long edges, well, I got to figure out what the number of long edges are, and so the number of hubs turns out to be n over l squared, so the number of pairs is n over l squared squared, the length of each of those routes is n to the half, so I get this term towards the bottom for the length of long edges, and now especially in calculus we have to sort of minimize the sum, a sort of little polynomial in L, and it's in a strange polynomial, but the sum is minimized by taking the side length of my hub squares and order n to the 3 over 2, and I get total length n to 13 over 10. So this construction, of course, works for arbitrary points. It gives a network with property 1, and property 1 is basically saying that the sort of average number of transfers, the average number of times you have to change planes in this system, goes to 2, and the length scales with the number of cities of order n to the 13 over 10. It's easy to guess that you sort of can't do better. Somehow, if you actually think, if our constraint has got the mean number of times you change plane to be 2, how could you do it in some different way? It's not obvious to prove anything like that, but on the other hand, it's not hard when you think about it for a few days. So the actual theorem here, so I'm wanting a sort of lower bound on feasible networks. Of course, this all depends on things being actually two-dimensional. If I had all my cities in a line, things would be different. So there's some technical notion of being really two-dimensional in some fractally sense, which I won't go into. But as long as my configuration of cities is really two-dimensional, then you can't do better than this length in an order of magnitude sense. So again, this is another case, again, like the examples of Gessler and Newman, where there's some easy intuition, and you can actually prove, in this case, in an order of magnitude sense, that your intuitive idea of what a good network is right. However, it's still a long way from understanding what the actual optimum network is. I mean, so I believe there's a much stronger result that somehow the actual optimum network is in some very strong sense very similar to a hub and network, to a hub and spoke network, that there really are things that act as hubs. But again, going from sort of orders of magnitude to actual constants, the exact optimum, it seems very difficult, even in rather trivial models like this. Okay, so here we mentioned air passenger networks, etc. For the rest of the talk, I want to focus down on road networks for several reasons. One is that I'm interested in data, and thank you Google Maps, Bing Maps, MapQuest, etc. We have instant access to an unlimited amount of data about road networks. And so I can have my undergraduates get data. So what is it I want to do with road networks? Another reason this is interesting is that it's somehow slightly different from what people have studied intensely. Because people who come at networks from graph theory think draw a graph as vertices and straight line edges between them. So if I put a bunch of vertices in the plane, put straight line edges between them, again, that's a sort of view of a spatial network from graph theory. So to such a person, this network isn't connected. Of course, to me, it is connected. These are roads. I can just drive here, drive to there. So in other words, I'm thinking of what doesn't quite have a standard name, but you loosely call Steiner networks. In fact, we sort of all know, even if we've never actually been taught it in class, is the fact that when I have 4 points in a square, the shortest length network that connects them is a network that looks like this. This is sort of shorter total length than that. the shortest network is by definition the finer tree on a set of points, and so we're thinking of networks where sort of where we put build roads is arbitrary, and we can put junctions which are not the specified networks. And there's a curious kind of math blind spot here, and it comes from the fact that sort of the finer tree is analogous to the minimum spanning tree, where I sort of insist on straight line edges between given vertices. And of course, one of the first things you sort of learn in a course on sort of computer algorithms is that computing a minimum spanning tree is easy by the greedy algorithm, whereas computing the Steiner tree is an NP-hard problem, which you don't know how to do. And so this has given a little prejudice against people looking at Steiner networks in general. Though for the sorts of things I'm doing, it turns out the Steiner networks are much easier to study than sort of graph networks, so I'm constrained to only have straight edges between vertices. And basically, you have just much more freedom to design things. So, for example, one way of building a finer network, and I don't mean a finer tree, I just mean a network where I'm allowed to put edges anywhere I like. One way of thinking about building a finer network to connect points a little, is to say, let's first put down a square grid of roads and completely ignore the points we're trying to connect. And now what I do is, for each point, I'm now going to kind of connect it in some way like this to the boundaries of its square. So this looks like a sort of pretty inefficient way of building a network here. Again, I'm thinking of this on a large scale, because some of my edges are going to be wasted. On the other hand, it's mathematically very nice, so it is somewhat inefficient, but on the other hand, this is sort of mathematically rather trivial to analyze. You can sort of analyze worst-case distances, worst-case route lengths between points, and you can analyze sort of the mean density, the mean length per unit area of these networks like this, very trivially. So the little constructions are genuinely easier for Steiner networks than for regular or graph networks. But so that's the setting I'm working in. Again, I'm just going to quickly mention the sort of thing I do in this case with master's students. There's a notion called either stretch or spanning ratio for any network in the plane, which is just for each pair of points. There's a route length in the network between them, which is, of course, greater than the Euclidean distance. You can look at the ratio of route length over Euclidean distance, and you can look at the maximum of that over all pairs of points. There's some literature called geometric spanner networks that talks about these things from an algorithmic point of view. But to connect with probability, we take our points as a rate one Poisson process. And now I can consider the question that if I want to construct a network over the Poisson point process, for which this stretch, this worst case ratio of route length to Euclidean distance is a given number S, or less than or equal to S. Again, there's some optimum network, just abstractly, and this has some minimum possible length per unit area for such a network. This is just sort of a function of S. And what can you say about this? And if you look at sort of standard results out there, there's sort of exactly sort of one bound that we have, which is by considering the Lornai triangulation, dual to Voronoi tessellation that we've been hearing a lot about. So there's sort of this worst case result, and it's kind of an impressive result in this algorithmic literature, that sort of just for the worst case realization of points, that of course happens somewhere in a Poisson process, so somehow when it comes to worst case, random and non-random are the same, because any configuration happens somewhere, but the worst case stretch is bounded by a certain constant, 2.442. And similarly, it's in principle straightforward to calculate the sort of length per unit area of the Lornai triangulation over Poisson processes, and again, that's a known number, 3.40. So by just considering the Lornai triangulation on the Poisson point process, we sort of get an upper bound at one point of this function. And again, for many years I've been sort of suggesting to master students, beginning PhD students, try and get upper and lower bounds on this function by being clever. And one of them actually did it 6 years ago, so we have one contribution from this. So again, we have a paper, after 6 years sitting in my drawer, I said, okay, I'm going to put it on archive. So recently posted on archive is a paper giving our upper and lower bounds on this function, which are embarrassingly crude, which is why I'm not going to tell you what they are. But, there's scope both for clever ad hoc constructions to improve upper bounds, and, again, let me sort of sketch some. Sorry, stretch is just defined as the maximum over pairs. So for each pair of points, there's a shortest route through the network, which has a route length. You compare that to straight line length. And so you look at the ratio, which is something bigger than one, and then you look at the worst case pair of points. Yeah. So the lower bounds, briefly depend on sort of a fact from stochastic geometry that's maybe better known to many of you than to me, which is that for an arbitrary network in the plane, or arbitrary subject to translation and rotation invariance, say, then there's just a deterministic relationship between the length per unit area, which I'm interested in, and the rate at which the network intersects a given straight line. So this is one of the sort of fundamental facts here. So when it comes to lower bounds, which we need theoretical arguments, we want to say that there don't exist networks with both small mean length per unit area and small stretch. So we have to do some abstract argument. We can't do a construction to show that. So basically it's saying we're trying to lower bound how often this network intersects the x-axis, say. And the point is that if I'm telling you that the stretch is less than S, then when I have a Poisson point down here and a Poisson point down there, if my constraint is that the route length between here is less than S, I think of S as a little bit bigger than 1 here, S is small, saying that the route length is only slightly bigger than the straight line length, is saying that the route has to intersect in some interval here. It's the interval whose edge points are such that the route from here to the end point to there is S times the straight line distance. So now for every sort of pair of points of my Poisson process, I have an interval of the x-axis in which the route must intersect the x-axis. So this is odd, because I really have to do this for every pair of points above and below. Of course, if the points are a long way away, these intervals are very large, but so that isn't the problem, because what I have to take care about is the small intervals. So the network has to have a property that there's a crossing point in every interval. So there's some unknown sort of stationary non-Poisson process of crossing points, which is subject to the property that one of these crossing points has to be in each of these intervals determined by point pairs, and we want a lower bound on what the mean intensity of these crossings has to be. And it turns out you can do that, of course. I mean, you can do this by some sort of slightly tedious second moment method, which I think gives the right order of magnitude as S goes down to 1. But it's just a sort of a slightly non-standard calculation to do with a Poisson process. Okay, how are we doing here? Half an hour. So, back to data, I said I want to look at things suggested by data. Here I'm showing this black blob. It's a black blob because it's 200 choose 2, which is about 10,000 points here. So we've taken the 200 biggest population cities in the United States. We were all surprised to learn that Austin seems to be the 11th biggest population city in the country. It's very hard to believe. Wikipedia says it, it has to be true. Yes. So for each pair of cities, so a dot represents a pair of cities, and again, for each pair of cities, we've looked at the distance on the x-axis is the straight line distance between them with some odd normalization I won't go into. And the vertical axis is this sort of excess route length. So I'm plotting a point at 0.3 to mean the route length is 30% longer than the straight line distance. So if you look at this, you see a couple of things. The more remarkable things, again, the colored lines, you can barely see averages within the vertical strips. That is this average excess route length as a function of distance between them. And that's sort of remarkably constant, about 18%. So again, typically route lengths are about 18% longer than straight line lengths. And it's remarkably constant over very different scales here. Even though the spread around this average is going down, so in some sense there's a law of large numbers, a law of averages effect, but as for further and further apart cities, the sort of variability around 18% is getting smaller. So that's just sort of data. We don't have a model for actual road network. These are some, again, theoretical or accurate simulations from, or fairly accurate simulations from probability models. Again, these are sort of three networks get on a Poisson process of points, the Delaunay triangulation, the Gabriel graph is slightly sparser, the relative neighborhood graph is slightly sparser. These are proximity graphs where there are deterministic local rules that tell you which neighboring points you're going to connect a given point to. They're designed to be automatically connected. I should say, as a kind of convention, network implies connected. Yes. For me. So we are sort of looking at models of intrinsically connected graphs here, so I don't have any infinite route lengths here. And again, what we're seeing here is close to what we saw in the city data, that after a sort of short distance, these averages tend to flatten out. We're having a sort of law of large numbers. Of course, it depends on how sparse or non-sparse the graph is. On the other hand, of course, the actual networks, a typical proximity graph on random points is given on the right, and that doesn't really look much like the sort of a large-scale road network of the United States. Courtesy of Wikipedia that knows everything, there's something called the National Highway System. I've never met any American who knows that America has a National Highway System, but under that name, but Wikipedia knows it, so you can actually find a map of the National Highway System, which is some bureaucratic designation of interstates and other strategically important roads. So there you are, 160,000 miles of it. So these just look different. And in fact, what's the actual difference? So, A and B. We've sometimes heard these called Alice and Bob in previous talks, but here it's Austin and Berkeley. If the actual road network was like something on the right, on a bigger scale, then what would be happening for the sort of shortest length route is that sort of where it would be roughly close to the straight line, but of course the individual segments aren't parallel to it, so we kind of, it's not really this close, but we visualize it as a sort of zigzag route staying close to the straight line, and so it's 18% longer because of the zigzag, it's not because it deviates. So the question is, how do you actually get from Austin to Berkeley? And the answer is you basically look for freeways going in the right direction, so you kind of have Interstate 10 going along here. And of course it's not really straight, but it's roughly straight. And then you have sort of Interstate 5 going up here. And then you jiggle around from Austin to wherever you get onto Interstate 10, and from Berkeley to wherever you get onto Interstate 5, and you sort of jiggle back to your apartments in here. So somehow this ends up somehow as being 18% longer on average than a straight line distance, but in a very different way. Instead of sort of zigzags around a global straight line, it's somehow in the middle, sort of straightish lines, but not going in exactly the right direction. And somewhat surprisingly, I'm not going to mention it here, but one of my more technical issues is something I call scale invariant random spatial networks. And this is a class of models which basically does include things that are looking qualitatively like, you know, this actual interstate networks. That is, we have sort of major roads that go a long way in a straight line, and on which you can go faster on, and therefore you tend to, your actual routes you go from one place to another in the model are much more qualitatively similar to what we actually do here. Okay, so here's again another sort of theorem suggested by these data considerations. So I want to think of a network as sort of starting with the points and then putting in the edges. So I want to first think of some totally arbitrary deterministic rule, where you input the vertices and you output where the edges are. And then I want to say, well, I want this rule to be sort of translation and rotation invariant. That is, in other words, sort of what I connect a given city to just depends on sort of what I see relative to that city, not where the city is in the plane. And the rule always produces a connected network. And you can do that by fiat, for example, by making sure you always include the minimum spanning tree. So we have this deterministic rule that we then just, which in principle we could apply to any configuration of cities. We're going to apply it to our Poisson point process of cities. So it's now connected. I could think of the route length between two typical cities at distance apart, RD. I can ask whether this expectation grows linearly in D, where there's a linear upper bound in distance. If so, a subadditivity argument implies, not quite trivially, but intuitively, a subadditive ergodic theorem is going to imply that this actually is a law of large numbers, that in the limit we converge to a constant, C. So the actual issue is sort of, for what networks do we actually have a linear rather than superlinear bound on the mean route length between points? And your first intuition might be this always holds for any connected network, but when you look at the minimum spanning tree, you can sort of visually see it doesn't. Routes in the minimum spanning tree are basically fractal. The typical route length between points at distance d apart goes at d to the power 1.23 or something by simulation, and it's known to be bigger than 1. So we sort of don't have the linear property here, and in fact that's a consequence of treeness. So you can more or less prove, it has to be true by analogy with something else that's known for lattice subtrees, that no tree network can have this linear growth property. However, a vague conjecture is that it's really only treeness that's the problem. So a very vague conjecture is that we have this linear property for any network which, again, in some unspecified sense, isn't essentially a tree. And so let's give a theorem that proves this under some other assumptions. And again, the assumption isn't very hard. So the assumption is that I'm going to take a large L by L square. When I look sort of what's happening inside the square, and I think of inside the square as away from the boundary, again, I'm using some rule which says, you know, I'm standing at a city, I'm using some rule that depends on where all the other points are relative to my city, and that rule is telling me which of my neighboring cities to put edges to. And I want to say that, sort of, consider at a given city or all the roads to its neighbors, which my rule doesn't depend on what's happening to the configuration of cities outside this big square. So if I sort of just put in this sort of sub-network, I can now define this sub-network of roads that are always there regardless of what happens outside the big square, and then I want to say that the sort of large connected component of this sub-network within the square contains the proportion 1 minus 0, 1 of all the vertices within the square. So it's roughly saying that sort of except near the boundary of a large square, roads are present or absent by the rule, regardless of what's happening outside the square. And in this condition, which is quite easy to check in all the sort of standard models one might think of, implies that we have a linear upper bound on mean route length, and then, as I said before, subadditivity implies there's actually a law of large numbers and a constant. And again, we have a sort of a hack proof in a couple of papers, again, on archive for 5 years, and kind of hate publishing hack proofs, and either a graduate student of mine or some other people, Chris Hirsch and people, are sort of working on nicer proofs. So at some point there'll be a nicer published proof of this. Okay, where am I getting to? 15 minutes. Okay. Well, as I said, I like thinking about road networks because easy access to data. Relating slightly to the last talk, a common thing people do in many contexts, if you're sort of looking at large networks and trying to say something about them, is to look at the frequency of small subgraphs, triangles, as the simplest example, and again, either noticing in data, or sort of assuming in a model that particular small subgraphs are sort of more common than they would be in some probability model. So again, jargon. Motifs for these subgraphs that are sort of present more often than a naive model would suggest. And of course, topics like this within classical Erdős-Rényi random graph theory, you can do detailed studies of sort of numbers of triangles in random graphs, etc. So I'm interested in sort of this way of looking at things, looking at frequencies of induced subgraphs within the context of road networks. So one of the things I have undergraduates do, it's good to have help, is take sort of four sort of street addresses, roughly in a square, and then for each pair of street addresses, you can sort of ask Google Maps to plot the route between them. But then I'm sort of superimposing this for all the 4 choose 2 equals 6 pairs of points. Again, I'm taking my the route between them, and I'm just sort of plotting all those routes together. So again, so I think of this as induced network, induced subnetwork of the real road network. Again, we're starting off with the real network. I could think of picking 4 points roughly in a square sort of at random. So even if there's no randomness in the real road network, we're sort of picking points at random. So we're getting a sort of a random probability distribution over sort of road networks linking 4 points within a square. And again, this is sort of the analog of looking for triangles or whatever in Erdős-Rényi graphs. What can I do with this data? As I said, the question of interest is to what extent the statistics of a subsquare we see in sort of a window on Google Maps depends on the actual real-world side length of the square, because you can't see very clearly what's going on in here. You can't quite tell if the edge length of the square between the points is sort of 25 miles or 100 miles, and so we have collected data on this for different lengths. In this case, it's actually 50 miles, but the issue is sort of whether, you know, when you plot these on the same size piece of paper, whether the distribution of what you see in this sub-networks depends much on the scale. The point being that in the sort of proximity graphs we were talking about before, again, if the real road network was like that, then when you took points a long way apart, the roads would be sort of always stay very close to the straight lines. And again, you can see in examples like this that for 50 miles there isn't a huge tendency for things to stay close to the straight line. I mean, the route Google Maps is giving us between here and here is going either round that way or round that way, for instance. So sometimes it's close to a straight line, but often it doesn't. The story isn't in on this. It's hard to get enough data, but it's, you know, there's a certain effect, not so definite, but it's sort of an interesting theory to pursue, is the idea that the statistical properties of these subnetworks don't actually depend on the scale, and this is what I call scale invariance. There's a sense in which, so scale invariance would imply in particular when you look at the route length between typical points, the distance d apart, rd, and divide by d, that should have a distribution that doesn't depend on d. That's somehow contradicted by an actual graphic of these route lengths between major cities, where it's got clear the distribution isn't the same in each strip, where it's getting more concentrated. On the other hand, the point is that cities are not typical points with respect to the road network, because the large-scale road network is designed to go between cities. And we actually think that if you could sample, you know, random street addresses, you have 150 million street addresses in the United States, so we don't have a very good way of actually sampling them in a convincing way. But we think we'd see more. Again, we imagine the corresponding graphic for random street addresses would have a weaker tendency to for the law of averages. And again, the scale invariance is saying somehow that the picture looks the same left to right without any reduction in SD here. There's only one bit of published data by other people that's relevant to this question, and they played this game of sort of sampling routes between random destinations. And what they did is, again, looked at the actual verbal description that Google gives you for a route, and say, you know, what proportion of what length of the route is on a particular road. Again, a particular road being defined by the sort of human naming conventions of Interstate 5 or State Highway 59 or whatever. And so when you sort of order these proportions of distances, they were finding these particular numbers, that sort of the average proportion of your journey on the longest stretch of road was sort of 40%, etc. And again, they're finding what scale invariance would predict, which is that these averages don't depend very much on the actual distance between the endpoints. So there's some evidence. As I said, with some flimsy support from such data, we use it as an excuse to study the mathematics of scale invariant networks. This is sort of part of some big picture. Again, I'm not going to say much of this. It's a picture that we had the graphons mentioned in the last talk, for instance. So graphons is an illustration of this general technique for understanding end-to-infinity limits of size n structures by sort of first sampling k random points, vertices, looking at the induced substructure on these k points, and then sort of letting n go to infinity for k fixed and getting a sort of limit structure on k points. But now these limit structures are inherently consistent as k varies, and so define sort of structure on an infinite number of points in some abstract sense, which you then try and make more concrete. So this is sort of pretty vague, but it's a sort of interesting technique that's sort of useful when it works. So I want to think about this in the context of spatial networks. So I want my spatial networks to be sort of exactly scale invariant. So the analog is random walks and Brownian motion. Random walks are sort of asymptotically scale invariant, the square root of n law. But if I want something to be exactly scale invariant, I have to be able to scale up and down, and that requires I'm working in the continuum. So the Brownian motion doesn't make sense as a discrete object. So similarly, to have a notion of an exactly scale invariant network, I need to be working in the continuum. So I have this sort of rather abstract notion of a network in the plane, a random network in the plane, with the property that, you know, for any two points I specify in the plane, I've gotten a route between them. And therefore, in particular, instead of thinking of two points, I can think of 57 points, and there's some subnetwork at all the routes linking the 57 points, and now sort of the whole network is defined as a limit as 57 goes to infinity here. And again, there's a theory about this. Again, this is the class of models that somehow is mimicking, in some qualitative sense, the actual ways that freeways seem to work over long distances. You can find a six-stage overview paper and don't read the technical paper. That's usually good advice here. Okay, what am I getting to? So let me say a final open problem that intrigues me slash annoys me, and it gets back to this issue I mentioned before, that sort of there's remarkably little study, kind of erased it, on sort of signer networks, or ways of constructing networks where you're allowed to put injunctions which aren't there originally. In particular, if I think of graph networks, networks where you're only allowed to put edges as straight lines between the vertices. I also mentioned at the beginning I'm interested in some one-parameter families, because our optimum networks are a cost-benefit trade-off, so that you always have one-parameter families there. There are two standard theoretical one-parameter families of graph networks here. One that's well-known, and again, proof by Wikipedia, if there's a Wikipedia page on it that makes it well-known, called the beta skeleton family. And again, that's by an entirely local deterministic rule for whether to put an edge between two networks or not. A less well-known example, or perhaps it's sort of well-known somewhere under another name I don't know, is the following idea. I kind of think of it as a frog taxi model. You can get from, hop from a place to another, but somehow it costs the frog more effort. To jump twice as far costs the frog more than twice the effort. So the power cost family of networks, again, I've on an arbitrary configuration of points in the plane, you say that in principle you can go directly from any vertex in your set to any other vertex, but the cost of that is the Euclidean distance to some power bigger than one. And now you always go from one place to another by the cheapest route. And so what that's saying is that there's a direct edge between two vertices. The direct edge is put there if its cost, which is distance to the p, is less than the minimum over alternate routes of the step lengths to the power p. And the point is that sort of for p equals infinity, this is exactly the minimum spanning tree characterization. As p goes down to 1, we get to the complete graph. So this family, on a sort of finite configuration, interpolates between the minimum spanning tree and the complete graph, and kind of on the Poisson point process, it just gives us a family of sort of increasingly dense graphs. Again, the issue is, again, these are just some nice monotone one-parameter families, which are sort of fairly tractable and elegant. But I don't know any sort of nice, tractable, elegant, aesthetic, whatever adjective you want. I don't know any nice way which inputs an arbitrary configuration of points and outputs a signer graph that's sort of plausible as a graph you might want to drive on if it was the road network. That's just a puzzle, because sort of I don't know why it's easy to do models for graph networks and hard to do. I don't know sort of why it's sort of hard to think of examples of this. It just is. And of course, if you want them to be computationally tractable, which we do, because otherwise you don't have much hope of analyzing it, then we sort of can't go all the way down to the signer tree, which isn't computationally easier, but that doesn't really matter. I'm not saying we go all the way down to the signer tree. I just want some sort of variable parameter I can put in and get a range of signer networks. It just doesn't seem to work well. So I'm going to stop talking here. That's my overview of things I think about with spatial networks. Thank you for your attention.
Do we have questions or comments?
From what I understand, you somehow try to gain exchangeability in a spatial network.
Yeah. Right, it isn't quite exchangeability. So you're right, I was cheating a bit there, because we actually are preserving the spatial positions. So exchangeability is a bit disingenuous. It's more sort of random sampling. So it's really the notion of examining a complicated structure by just looking at substructures on randomly sampled points. And that, you're right, they're not actually exchangeable in this context. Yeah. They are in the other contexts where it's used.
Show that the Delaunay triangulation gives a smaller stretch factor than the Gabriel graph, for example.
Right.
Yeah. So is there anything that beats Delaunay?
Well, you know, again, it's a trade-off. I mean, you can simply add more edges. I mean, you know, if you're just trying to reduce the stretch without any other constraint, you just add more edges, and somehow, basically, there are things called theta graphs, where basically you sort of, at each point, you sort of divide your 360 degrees into, you know, 16 equal wedges, and kind of connect to the closest point in each wedge. So this gives you sort of graphs with much larger length per unit area, but you can make the sort of stretch factor arbitrarily small. So again, the issue is the sort of trade-off between stretch and length. Yeah.
Are there further questions or comments? Well, if not, let us thank the speaker.
Okay.
So we've all had a very